Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
The melting Arctic? That's far enough away. Electric cars or solar cities? That's far enough away, too. But talk about fewer babies, those cute, lovable babies, or stopping immigration, or maybe state control of family size, and those are bombs that stimulate a kind of self-censorship even Greens go along with. Start talking about population control, and even the best listeners may start reaching to change that radio dial. And when I add that our guest, Philip Cafaro, specializes in ethics, that may not help. Ethics is hardly the hot buzzword of the day on TV or social media. So, Philip, we have about 30 seconds to convince our great Radio EcoShock listeners they need to hear this conversation. Why drag up population, immigration, and birth control just when we're finally getting the public on board with the reality of climate change?
Well, Alex, I think the fundamental reason is because people care about nature. They want to preserve the environment. They want to keep other species with us on the planet. And they want their children and grandchildren to live in a flourishing natural world. And you can't do that if you're not willing to look at population issues.
Well, I think personally there's a deep and embedded form of self-censorship at work here. I didn't necessarily look forward to doing this program. The whole issue makes me uncomfortable and maybe unpopular. But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, stopping climate catastrophe is not all happy thoughts and popularity. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. You know, it's great when we can find win-win solutions, and we need to look for those. But at the same time, as with anything in life, you have to confront the reality if you're going to move forward.
I think I should tell you, listeners, Philip Cafaro teaches philosophy at Fort Collins at Colorado State University. He's the co-editor of a new collection of essays called Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. The contributors are real green leaders, some of them already guests on Radio EcoShock, like Albert Bartlett, Lester Brown, and Paul Ehrlich. He does the introduction. And we hear from academics, but also from activists, too, like Dave Foreman of Earth First and Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society. So, Philip Cafaro, please give us a short introduction to this book, and then we'll try to defuse some of those bombs before they blow.
Well, Life on the Brink deals with the environmental impacts of overpopulation, and we deliberately went out and looked for contributors from a wide range of places, but we wanted to find people who, in general, had a biocentric outlook. So in other words, people who are sort of committed to the idea that human beings should share habitat and resources with other species. Quite often when people talk about population issues, it's all in terms of human carrying capacity. How many people can the Earth support, or can this particular region support? And that's an important question. But we also think it's important to ask, what would the optimum population be? And what should our population be if we want to keep bears and wolves and other species on the landscape with us? So our contributors explore those kinds of questions. They look at different ecosystems from the southeast to the Pacific Northwest. They look at wildlife issues, sprawl issues, water issues, and always with this question, how can we address population so that we can preserve the environment?
All right, well, why don't we dive into the contentious issue of immigration? In the United States, new polls show millions of Latinos are concerned about climate change. Now you seem to be saying we should stop immigration. It's a hot issue not just in the U.S., but in Australia and Canada, the U.K., most developed countries in Europe. Why, oh why, would environmentalists get involved in immigration debates?
Well, Alex, as I think you know, most environmentalists have run as quickly in the other direction as possible from that. So it's only a small minority of us who think that we do have to look at it. But the reason, especially in countries like the United States and Canada, to look at immigration is because in the United States, at least, we've managed to stabilize our population in terms of the fertility rates of the people living here. So if we did not have immigration, or if immigration was a lot lower than it is today, we'd essentially be looking at stabilizing our population at a few tens of millions of people more than it is today. So maybe at 330, 340 million people. At our current level of immigration, which is about 1.25 million annually, we're instead going to nearly double our population. So at our current level of immigration, we're looking at about 570 million people in the United States by 2100. Now, I would submit to your environmentally concerned listeners out there that it's going to be hard enough to create a sustainable United States or Canada with our current populations. If we double our populations, it's going to be just about impossible.
Well, plus, if we take people from an area, say, in Central America where they're using very little carbon, we bring them up to the States, they want that decent standard of American living, we get cars, maybe several cars per family, what happens then?
Yeah, it's really true. It turns out when you look at ecological footprints for the average American versus the average person from our main immigrant sender countries, Americans use about 3.5 times the resources, emit about 3.5 times the carbon, etc., as people in our main sender countries, Mexico, the Philippines, China, etc. So when you move people to the United States, not only are you increasing their resource use, but you're most likely increasing the resource use of their descendants down the line.
Well, let's talk about the scientists. What is the position of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, on population and climate change?
Well, that's a very interesting question. If you go to the IPCC's 2007 report, they're just unequivocal that population growth is one of the main drivers, one of the two main drivers of increased greenhouse gas emissions, which in turn are driving climate change. So the IPCC says, basically, the reason we've had increased emissions over the past 3 and 4 decades is that population has grown and per capita wealth has grown. Economic activity per person has grown. You take those two things together, and they've really swamped the good increases we've had in efficiency, in energy efficiency, and that's why we're generating more carbon. On the other hand, it's interesting, once you look at the proposals in the IPCC report to actually deal with climate change, they say almost nothing about reining in population growth. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
Right. We're going to bury the carbon. We're going to stop using as much carbon. We're going to change the way we drive cars maybe, but nothing about population.
Right. You know, the problem with that approach is, well, the main problem is there's a good chance it won't be sufficient to actually give us the carbon reductions we need to get a hold on the problem. Another problem with it, though, is when you keep pursuing efficiency improvements, what happens is you sort of grab the low-hanging fruit, you improve the efficiency, but of course, if you just keep adding more and more people, you're going to need more resources eventually, and then it's going to be much harder to get even more efficiency because you've sort of grabbed all the easiest things. There's a sense in which by not addressing population growth and economic growth, we may be boxing ourselves in and making it harder, not easier, to deal with the problem down the line.
But just look at the decades of abuse Paul and Ann Ehrlich took for their 1968 book, The Population Bomb. And then you've got the late American ecologist Garrett Hardin. He became the whipping boy when he discussed trying whatever it takes to limit human population. Is it any safer to talk about this now? Are you prepared for the verbal bricks coming your way?
Well, I am. You know, I in my own case, I've been an environmentalist for about 30 years, and for the first 20 of those or so, I really didn't talk about population, but I noticed that whatever else I was talking about, whether it was trying to keep water in rivers or keep new ski areas from destroying mountains, there was always a population component to it. Population growth was being used to justify the projects that I was trying to slow down. So eventually I waded into it, and what I found was you sort of get hated on in an equal opportunity way. People on the left don't really like it when you talk about immigration and reducing immigration. On the other hand, people on the right often don't like it when you talk about contraception or, heaven forbid, abortion rights. So maybe that's the only silver lining in this. You get it from both sides, and maybe that lets you keep standing.
Well, maybe that's why the big green groups, I mean, even brave ones like Greenpeace, don't want to talk about population control. They need to keep their supporters. They need to keep their funding. So how do we get around that one? I mean, this is the issue that almost broke up the Sierra Club in California.
Well, that's right. And it's hard. And I don't think every group has to deal with every issue. You know, people join a group like the Sierra Club for certain reasons. And if the club starts talking about completely different things, then they're going to be uncomfortable. But I do think there are some issues we just can't avoid, and I think population is one of them. Perhaps if these groups would, they don't even have to take a stand on the issue at this point, I think, if they could just start talking about it, if they could just start maybe having articles in their wonderful magazines about what some people think the role of population might be in, and just get people talking about it, I think that would be a great step forward.
Well, how much time do we have? Can we just start initiating a quiet, careful conversation, or do we have to really get going and do something about it?
I think we need to get going. And again, you know, it's kind of funny. We talk about climate change. We talk about these massive dead zones at the mouths of many of the world's great rivers. Scientists are talking very seriously about the disappearance of most of the world's coral reefs in 20 to 30 years. I take these as signs that humanity as a whole is really pushing up against some limits here. I think there's really no time to waste, and we need to get talking about these things.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Phil Cafaro. He's the president of the International Society for Environmental Ethics, and he's the president of the Board of Directors for Progressives for Immigration Reform. We're talking about a new book that challenges environmentalists and policymakers and the public to face up to the real climate damage caused by overpopulation. The book's many essayists argue we can't stop the worst climate change unless we stop population growth. So, Phil, on the plus side, what could we achieve as far as emissions go if we do manage to limit population growth?
Well, it turns out that there's an awful lot we can achieve through that. If you look at the United States, something like 5/6 of our emissions increases over the past 2.5 decades have come from population growth. So if we could get a handle on that, there are just very large savings that we could make. And of course, if you can manage to combine population stabilization with some of the good technological improvements that people are also working on, then you could see greenhouse gas emissions start to be pushed down. The problem is that in too many countries around the world, we've made good efficiency improvements in recent years, but we've used them to subsidize greater population growth. We need to get these things moving together.
Well, let's talk about how we do it. Slowing or reversing population growth is great so long as I don't have to do it. We want our kids and grandchildren just as we always have. Does voluntary population control work?
Well, I think it can work. I mean, the good news is an awful lot of what we want to do really is that kind of win-win solution that we talked about at the start of the program. In the developing world, where 95% of population growth is currently happening, there's very good evidence that when you give women and couples the opportunity to choose the number of children they have, they tend to choose to have fewer. So if we can manage to get contraception to the 250 million women around the world who want it but at this point in time don't have it, if we can get that to them inexpensively or for free, and if we can improve women's education, if we can improve the economic and social status of women around the world, those things have been proven to help drive down fertility rates. Now, when you look at countries like Canada and the United States, as I said earlier, there we've already made that demographic transition. We're already having fewer children voluntarily. And in Canada and the United States, the key to population stabilization is to reduce immigration. Now, a lot of people aren't going to like to hear that, but the reality is, in the past, we have had much lower immigration rates, and immigration rates are a function of the political choices we make. So we really, in this case, might have to choose between bringing in large numbers of people and benefiting them, perhaps in the short run, or stabilizing our populations.
Well, what about the case of India and China? Doesn't that show some state coercion may be necessary, like the one-child program? And the other thing about this new book of essays, Life on the Brink, I didn't see any authors from China or India in there. Why is that?
Well, Eileen Christ and I, the editor, we did reach out to various writers around the world. We would have liked to have gotten a little bit more of an international scope to the book. In the end, we went forward with the writers we had who made the commitments. But to get to your earlier question, what about coercion in China and India? There's no doubt that coercion has been there. In China, at least, it seems to have worked. There's something like 300 million fewer Chinese today than there would have been without the one-child policy. But interestingly enough, if you look at some of the nations right around China, they have driven fertility levels even lower than China has, and without using coercion. So in Thailand, in Vietnam, I think the numbers, fertility levels are way down. So that suggests to me that while coercion maybe has worked in some places in the past, you don't need coercion to drive fertility levels down. And that's good news, because we don't want to violate human rights in order to create a sustainable society. We want both of those things.
Well, getting back to the United States, I mean, Americans are finally willing to read about climate change. It was just in USA Today a couple of weekends ago. Even occasionally they might hear the president mention it. Are we ready to stir up this hornet's nest of anti-abortionist conspiracies about government control and the UN taking over? I could just hear this tsunami of ugly noise cranking up all over again. Is there any way to avoid all that nuttiness?
Well, there's no way to avoid the nuttiness completely. Because let's face it, when you open up a public debate, that means people get to have their say, and some of the public are going to be nuts. I think the best way to avoid the nuttiness is to do what we're doing right now, to try to have an intelligent discussion about these questions. That's why I was so disappointed back in the late 90s when the Sierra Club decided not to take a position on immigration in the United States. The rationale for that, in part, was, look, this debate's going to get ugly. We don't want to have anything to do with it. But actually, I think that's an abdication of our role as citizens. You know, the way to have a good debate is to have a good debate. It's not to just run away and expect a good debate to happen.
Could you tell us about just a couple of the arguments used by the longtime Greens in your new book, Life on the Brink?
Sure. Some people have a little bit more of an international focus, and some have a more North American focus. So that makes a difference to the kinds of arguments they make. But one very good argument comes from Tim Palmer, who's a longtime river advocate in California and along the west coast of the U.S. Tim talks about the work that he's done over the past 3.5 decades in California, the work he and other river advocates have done to convince people to leave more water in the rivers. They've had wonderful success at keeping some bad dam projects from being made, wonderful success in getting people to use both industry and agriculture and individuals to use water more efficiently. So in California today, people actually use about half as much water per capita as they did 4 decades ago. And Tim says, well, this is a wonderful achievement. The only problem is we've got twice as many people in California today. So there's just about as much pressure as there was 4 decades ago to take more water out of the rivers. And that means that's bad for fish, that's bad for ecosystems throughout California. So his point is just this: it's an exercise in futility, if you're an environmentalist, to push really hard for efficiency improvements and not deal with population issues.
Phil Cafaro, when I spoke with Paul Ehrlich recently, he said each additional human is far more than just one more. Why are the next 100 million humans more damaging than ever before?
Well, Paul says that for two main reasons. First, this next 100 million people are coming online, as it were, at a time when we're more technologically advanced than ever. And so they are going to be coming here, and their wants and the way they fulfill their needs, the way society meets their needs, is going to be much more resource intensive than 100 million people, let's say, 50 years ago. Another reason why those 100 million people are more important and more impactful is, in many ways, humanity has gone after the easiest, most accessible resources first. So now, in order to get those people, let's say, the oil and gas that they need, you might well have to be, for the oil, you might have to be drilling a couple miles under the ocean. And that means to get them their oil, you're taking a much greater environmental risk. So in all these ways, adding more people at this stage of the game is more impactful.
Well, that's why I was so discouraged to see China go for the car culture. I know they're doing a lot in renewable energy and they're working on mass transit. They've got more rapid trains than the United States has. But, you know, it just seems like they didn't learn anything from the smog of L.A. in the early days, and now they've got it in Beijing. Maybe they saved 300 million people with the one-child policy, but they lost it all in emissions because they went for coal and cars. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that was a terrible way to go. It would have been much better to see them move in a direction of more mass transit and to keep bicycle culture for shorter trips. But, you know, that's not the way they moved. And I think part of it was a calculation about how much economic growth they could generate by getting people interested in having their own car. I mean, think about the role that plays in the economy, the automotive industry plays in the economies of Canada and the United States. And I think China's leaders looked at that and said, we want that. And China's people looked at cars and said, we want that. So that's the way it went.
Right. But all of our talk, even in this conversation, is about humans and what it means for humans. Do we really have the right to use all the photosynthesis, all the fresh water, every living space just for our growing needs?
I don't think we do. And that's a big part of the book. Well, I have a piece in there that I wrote with a graduate student arguing that other species have a right to continued existence on planet Earth. They have a right to be free from anthropogenic extinction. Now, I believe that very strongly, and we have good, strong laws, both in the United States and in Canada, to protect endangered species, which at some level make that same connection. What we haven't been able to do is say there's a connection between preserving species and limiting the size of the human population and human economies. I think that's where we're at right now. That's what environmentalists have to grapple with. How do we make real this idea that other species have a right to continued existence? We have to acknowledge limits and figure out ways to justly live within limits.
Well, I think part of that is just to get people outside the cities into nature to actually experience that there is a world beyond the iPads and all of that. I know you've been looking into past mass extinction events. I'm wondering if we can see another one coming. Are we already in it? Would we even recognize it before we blow past any chance to stop it?
The biologists tell us that we have entered that period. There's a lot of debate about exactly, you know, what's happening at this moment. There's a lot of debate about if current trends continue, will we lose a quarter of the world species in the next century or only half that number? But as I read the science, the biologists seem pretty convinced that we have entered the period of the sixth great mass extinction on Earth. And that's a sobering thought. The loss is just going to be tremendous. Species themselves are going to be lost. I think future human generations are going to find a much more crowded and much more depauperate world. I see my job in all this is trying to sound the alarm about that and maybe do my small part to try to limit that loss. But the loss is coming.
Well, bottom line here, Philip Cafaro, what should Greens be saying and doing about the population issue? What should we all be doing and saying?
Well, above all, we should be talking about it. I don't think we have to all come to exactly the same personal or policy conclusions about that. But on the personal level, I mean, for me, after I had my two children, I had a vasectomy. That seemed to me to be a very important thing to do as a good environmentalist. On a policy level, I think we should be, in the United States at the moment, we're talking about comprehensive immigration reform. Whatever the final bill that Congress passes looks like, I think we should discuss what the implications are of that bill for future U.S. population growth. And at the international level, I think whatever the wealthy nations of the world can do to help provide resources for contraception in poorer countries, that can just do a world of good. So there's a lot we can do, but I think it all starts with realizing that every person makes certain demands on the planet, and we have to take that into account if we want to be good environmentalists.
So what is next for you? What are you working on?
Well, currently I'm finishing up a book looking at immigration policy and ethics in the United States, and then I'd like to step back a little and maybe develop further these arguments that people really should respect other species and acknowledge their right to continued existence. I'm interested in making those arguments as strong as possible.
We've been talking about the almost unspeakable, the huge impacts of human population growth on climate change and the species. Our guest is Philip Cafaro. He's the co-editor of a new book, Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. It's a collection of fine essays, in my opinion, from some of the biggest progressive names in American environmentalism. The other editor is Eileen Crist from Virginia Tech, known for her book, Gaia in Turmoil. The book is published by University of Georgia Press. Find links to Philip and the book in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Phil, thank you for standing up when others duck the tough issues.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall never surrender.
As always, please support your local nonprofit radio station. One of the best since 1960, WBAI New York is in emergency fundraising mode to keep their famous transmitter atop the Empire State Building. That station has not yet recovered from being flooded out by Hurricane Sandy. In fact, every nonprofit and community radio station needs your help right now more than ever. Don't take anything for granted. If you love freedom of the airwaves without corporate control, please get online or on the phone and put your money where your ears are to support your local radio station. A huge thank you to Radio EcoShock supporters who keep this program on the air. Rebecca in Australia, your generous donation gave me renewed determination to keep pumping out the awful truth. I can't thank everyone personally, but listeners around the world make this show possible. I am grateful for donations coming in through our website and blog. Help yourself while you're there to our big library of free MP3 audio downloads at ecoshock.org. Coming up on Radio EcoShock, the new wave of low-energy homes and new waves of rising seas. Is it still safe to live near the coast? Plus, a surprise guest who always puts Earth first. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. I'm going to squeeze in part of another song from Nimbin, Australia. The group is Pagan Love Cult. It's their CSG song, meaning coal seam gas, also known as fracking methane.
From where I stand, I see this land as a paradise that's there for all to share. Green tree growing, water flowing, blue sky overhead, clean fresh air. But there's a corporate man with a short-term plan, licensed by the government to drill. He'll take what he wants and he'll trash the rest, leave behind a poison mess when his hat is filled. He's got the weight of the state on a golden plate. The cops, the courts, the rules.